This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. It has been a memorable year in South Florida. Also, a very tragic one. On February 14th, a gunman took an Uber to his former high school in Broward County, bringing with him an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle, unleashing terror.
Broward County Sheriff deputies and Coral Springs police are on the scene of the active shooter at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland.
Then I just see a bunch of people started running.
When they evacuated the school, many of them are telling me it was like a fire drill.
The teacher is saying, everyone go to this side. Let's go to Wesley's Middle School.
A student ran up behind one of the students that spoke with me, and he had a hole in his foot, and he just screamed, keep going.
And we just heard everybody screaming, saying to go back in because it was a code red.
Broward County Sheriff's Office confirming 17 people dead following the shooting at Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland. That's a suburb in Fort Lauderdale.
The massacre changed the debate in Florida around gun control, changed the debate around school safety here in South Florida and across the state. The Florida legislature passed the first restriction on guns in years. The new law moved up the age to buy a long gun from 18 to 21 years old. It also addressed school safety by mandating school resource officers in every public school and instituting the Guardian program, a program that allows some school staff to carry firearms. Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri chairs the state commission that was formed to investigate the shooting. He said the Guardian program should go further.
Prior to this and back in February after this first happened, my initial thought was it probably should be cops, because cops are those who are best trained and have the best equipment. But once you get into it and you find out what happened there at Stoneman Douglas and you look at the active assailant incidents over the last 20 years, it brings you to the realization that that's not going to work.
The commission recently released its draft report outlining recommendations to state lawmakers, including an effort to expand that Guardian program. So we are reviewing some of the biggest news in South Florida in 2018 with the editorial page editors from South Florida's three major media operations, Nancy Ankrum with our partner, the Miami Herald, Rosemary O'Hara with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post, along with us here on the South Florida Roundup. What's the biggest news story for you in 2018? How has the Florida recount stayed with you? We'll talk about that. What about your school community? How has it been impacted by the Parkland shooting? You can join our conversation today on Twitter. At WLRN is our handle. Rosemary, let's begin with you. As you are responsible for covering much of Broward County, the Parkland shooting changed the dynamic when it comes to the gun debate. It changes the dynamic when it comes to school security, when it comes to community involvement, student voices, young voters. It has upended a number of conversations that this community has. What is memorable to you about that tragic period so many months removed now?
Well, and it's not even removed. I mean, it starts with Valentine's Day, a day that will never stand for hearts and roses, but rather for the deaths, unnecessary, horrible deaths of 17 and wounding of 17. Immediately afterward, the conversation jumped to guns and gun control, and frankly, my disappointment that the Florida legislature failed to address banning military-style assault weapons that kill with such greater ferocity than a single bullet. But here at toward the end of the year now, and we were all waiting for the investigation to, before we jump to conclusions, let's see what the investigations show. And here at the end of the year, we now know of major failures in school safety by a number of people, both at the school and at the district. We know a number of failures in law enforcement, mm-hmm. that the proper training, the proper policies, the proper execution. And so it is where we go from here is we need a lot more money to make schools safer. And in my opinion, the last thing we need to do is arm teachers to be packing heat while they're in the classroom trying to get kids to learn.
Nancy Ankrum, this story put a spotlight, of course, on violence in schools. But it was a story that was familiar in many neighborhoods throughout South Florida, a story of individual tragedies happening in neighborhoods across the region, not every day, not every week, but as a familiar story. This got a lot of attention for obvious reasons. it being in a school environment. But the story of gun violence is a story that has permeated many South Floridian lives.
Absolutely. And this was, of course, just the biggest of gun violence stories this year. However, other people, people who live in inner cities, kids who have had their friends, you know, shot walking to school, shot in and killed in drive-bys, everyone who knows someone who was either killed or as important, wounded, mm-hmm. and survived. I would like to say that there was a great joining of forces here, but there really wasn't. Mm. However, I do think that the people we're talking about, the African-American communities, Hispanic communities, used this as a springboard to say, me too, us too.
Rick Christie, we did see communities, the youth voice especially, be utilized in this tragic aftermath in ways that we hadn't seen after previous school shootings, and really mobilize young voices, again, throughout South Florida, not just in the Parkland community or in the Broward community, but we saw student walkouts or student protests in Dade County. We saw them in Palm Beach County as well. We saw them across the country.
Mm-hmm. And you're right. I think Parkland is unique for that, in that for that it was able to motivate young people, and that I think a great deal of that is just due to the kids who were affected by it, and the fact that they just said that they weren't going to take it anymore. And it did prove to be a motivating factor for a lot of students around the country to hold their own protests and to talk about this in their own schools. While because I think even after Parkland there was an incident in Texas as well.
That's
at
right.
Texas High School.
Yep.
And I think that not just Parkland, but because of that incident as well, it just kept the movement and the energy going.
Nancy?
You know, I'd like to say that that was actually a bright side from this. And I think Floridians should be awfully proud about the reaction that the Parkland students had, the actions that they took. We have seen these shootings far too often across the country. And they recede, unfortunately, from the news pages. But the kids at Parkland and beyond kept it going. It was fortuitous that the legislature was in session and that, you know, many buses headed in that direction. And they were really able to, I'd say, cow cowardly legislators into doing something. Not enough, but into doing something.
Rosemary, one of the quick practical responses to this was because the legislature was in session. Prior to Parkland, if you'll recall, the conversation around the Florida legislative session really was in regards to sex and relationship between lawmakers,
right.
And relationship, personal relationship between lawmakers and lobbyists.
Right.
This upended that in a very real way, and it dominated legislators' conversation about how they were going to respond. And sure enough, the act that was compromised with bipartisan support put in place the first restrictions on gun ownership in Florida for the first time in about a generation or so, maybe about a half a generation. Those are being challenged, but also the very real response in terms of school security. And it is not likely to be the sole response from the legislator. Parkland parents and others are pushing for continued response in this next upcoming legislative session.
Right. It absolutely should not be the last response. But let's remember that when those kids were going up to Tallahassee, the vast majority of them wanted gun control, and they wanted something done about military-style assault weapons, and the legislature let them down, and that was not a bipartisan move. That was the Republican-led legislature that refused to even consider a ban on assault weapons. And so I remember the kids in the gallery who were crying that day. Does the legislature and Governor Rick Scott deserve some credit for doing something on the issue of guns after You know, he was in office 8 years. This was the first time he addressed the gun violence that we have seen in our neighborhoods, as you just mentioned.
There was no legislative response of any meaning after Pulse,
or this all of this gun violence that is increasing. And so, what they did in terms of gun violence was raise the age at which you can buy a rifle to 21, from 18 to 21. That's the age you can buy a handgun at, and had been the age. So that, you know, okay, that's something, but is that enough? You know, we still don't have the background checks. You can still buy something online. And I just want to make the point, too, that as school shootings, there have now been 46 incidents. One of the revelations from the commission's report is 46 attacks on schools in the last 20 years. And so let us do something about the root cause, which is these guns. The vast majority were guns and rifles. But we also need to do something about school safety. And what the legislature did on school safety, yeah, it required an SRO, but it didn't provide the money to hire them. Right. And so a lot of them started the year with part-time people or sharing them among their elementary schools. Yep. They need to put their money where their mouth is and put a lot more money toward school safety.
Some listener,
if I can add, yeah, Tom, go ahead, that they're using that as an excuse now for pushing this armed guardians thing, the volunteers, because sheriff's departments are saying they don't have the money, you know, to do exactly what Rosemary was talking about in terms of hiring more people and making sure that there is a school resource officer on every campus or armed guard, according to the law. And now you see this push from the commission that was set up to study what happened at Parkland now, pushing for to expand and make these armed guardians not just a voluntary thing, but to require it, and which is a scary proposition, to be honest with you. Going back to what we originally said, which was that you have police officers, school resource officers who are trained to deal with these situations, and even they make mistakes. Yeah. It's scary to imagine a teacher who is already under stress from teaching a high school class or whatever other kind of class, now having the responsibility of having a gun
to be
and protecting those students.
To be considered the first responder in this case, Nancy.
Yeah. Right, absolutely. You know, the commission, the legislature has been derelict, of course, in funding a raft of issues and initiatives. And in Miami-Dade County, school superintendent Alberto Carvalho used it as, I guess the word is, opportunity to, this past election season, present a referendum on raising money for teachers' raises. And also included in that referendum was money for SROs.
All four counties, as a matter of fact, had voters at some point in 2018 approve of higher taxes for school security. And in some cases, in some counties, Dade County and Broward County and Palm Beach County also, teacher salaries as well. Some listener comments real quick here. Let me get these in. Adriana in Miami wrote to us saying, as a pediatrician, the harsh reality of Parkland again brought the issue of guns to the forefront. Isabella in Hollywood texted us, as a high school student from Broward County, this tragedy opened my eyes and made me realize that school shootings should not become a normality and that something should be done about it. Susan in Davie, my daughter-in-law is a school psychologist and a graduate of Stoneman Douglas, so she became a mental first responder. Susan continues on, it was hard watching her go through trying to help people while at the same time suffering from her own grief. And then this note from Nathaniel in Pembroke Pines. The Stoneman Douglas shooting affected my family the most this year. My wife is a Broward County high school teacher, and while the Broward School District has new policies and procedures in place for my wife's protection as well as the protection of students, it's still an uncertainty that we will have to take into account next year. Rosemary.
Well, I think the policies he references are not all in place, and that is part of the criticism of the leadership of the Broward County School District in the face, you know, and Robert Runcie, the superintendent, is the face of that. And he certainly took his share of criticism but when he testified before the commission. But I wanted to follow up on Rick's point about it's scary, and it is scary, to think that The reason that the chair of the commission says that teachers should be armed is because most kids, people who die in all these school shootings, die within the first 3 or 4 minutes. Right. And at Parkland, they all died within or were shot within little over four minutes. And that you can't expect law enforcement to be on the scene. And so let us arm our teachers. Well, the teachers who were in the middle of that were locked down in their rooms or trying to be locked down in their rooms. They were too afraid to, and understandably so, to open the door to lock it from the outside, which is the only way you could lock it. They were too afraid to go to the intercom or the landline phone to call a code red. They were afraid and they were trying to hunker down with their kids. To expect them to open the door and be the first response when law enforcement was too afraid themselves to pursue the shooter is unrealistic.
What do you make of the criticism that those types of responses are happening, you know, in the heat of the moment and are responding to the reality of gun violence versus the ability for a school district or a community to identify troubled students, to put into place programs with troubled students, to have the ability to communicate action plans while still respecting student privacy and healthcare privacy? All of the criticism that the Broward County School District has had and other community organizations that have looked at the trajectory of the shooter's troubled school career that led to the tragedy on February 14th.
This kid had 69 violent incidents on his record since third grade, and yet there was, I mean, was law enforcement ever contacted by the school district for him bringing bullets, for fighting, for making threats? Law enforcement was never called. When after the incident happened, the superintendent said the Promise Program, which is trying to divert kids so they aren't forever, you know, they brought a joint to school. The Promise Program wasn't involved. Turned out he was referred to Promise. There were no consequences for his failure to show up. And the reason that the superintendent got that wrong is because of scattered record keeping. Yeah. The record keeping on kids, you know, it's one pile here and one pile over there, and who knows what the story is. And one school is passing it off to another and wanting to wash their hands, get rid of this kid. And so there was no continuity in the big picture of what was clearly a kid who had trouble written all over, a school shooter written all over him, whose fellow students were saying, he's a school shooter, he's making the threat. And people at the school didn't take it seriously. And in that case, they didn't use student privacy to say that, oh, we can't talk about it. They said, go look up the definition of autism. You know, they just, they were not serious in dealing with a threat that was right before their eyes.
I want to talk about one other story with tragic consequences. This was the story of the bridge collapse near Florida International University. It was just a month after the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas shooting when this new pedestrian bridge that was designed to carry FIU students and faculty and staff and others across Southwest 8th Street, it collapsed as vehicles sat right under the bridge waiting at a stoplight. The bridge hadn't opened yet. 6 people died. There's still an ongoing investigation and questions about the design of the bridge and why the road under it remained open to traffic while it continued to have work done on it. Nancy Ankrum with the Miami Herald, the state claims that the Florida Department of Transportation engineer was notified days before this collapse of some worrisome cracks. But there still remains questions about why this road remained open, even as this engineering marvel was turning into something much different.
Right. There is still a lot of finger pointing going on. We have not gotten the definitive report yet. My question is not only why this road remained open. My question is that standard operating procedure in this community and in this state? And has this tragedy caused FDOT and other responsible agencies to take a look at what the procedures are now? I suspect that a lot of roads remained open as bridge work is going on.
Just one of the many stories here we're reviewing on our Year in Review program here on the South Florida Roundup. Lots to talk about, including the election, the recount. Oh, and it turns out there were results of the election as well, eventually. We'll get into all of that as our South Florida Roundup, the Year in Review 2018, continues after this. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening and supporting WLRN throughout the year. We are taking a look back at some of the big news stories in South Florida in 2018. Broward County was in the center of a dramatic elections recount this year, missing the deadline to turn in its recounted votes for three statewide races, missing it by 2 minutes. Here's how Broward's former elections supervisor, Brenda Snipes, described it then.
Our completion was 3:02, and it should have been 3 o'clock. So I think the staff worked extremely hard to accomplish what we have accomplished in a very tight timeline.
We have moved from dimple chads to 2 minutes late in voting in South Florida. Palm Beach County was the only other Florida county that didn't make that recount deadline. It got delayed because voting machines broke down. Close races required all of these recounts, which went off without problems in most counties, but not in Broward and Palm Beach. After the elections were finally settled, the election supervisor in Broward, Brenda Snipes, said it was time to move on after serving in that position since 2003.
I think I have served the purpose that I came here for, which was to provide a credible election product for our voters.
Well, Snipes wound up rescinding her resignation after Governor Rick Scott suspended and then replaced her. The Florida Senate President, Bill Galvano, said there probably wasn't much confidence in Florida's elections process to start with going into Election Day this year.
We've sort of been painted with that brush since 2000. They definitely highlight that we have concerns, and then you see repeat problems in the South Florida counties. And I think by next election cycle, the voters are going to want to have more in terms of assurance that their votes are going to be properly counted.
All of this competed with the actual results of the elections, right? Republicans continue their hold on the governor's office here in Florida and the state legislature. The Republicans win a U.S. Senate seat from the Sunshine State, while Democrats pick up a couple of South Florida congressional elections, and voters decide that tens of thousands of felons in Florida, after completing their sentences, should be restored the right to vote. Our panel, looking back at 2018, the editorial page editors in South Florida, still with us, Nancy Ankrum with our partner, the Miami Herald, Rosemary O'Hara with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post. Well, where do we begin when it comes to elections 2018? I think we begin kind of where they ended, which is all of the recount trouble here, Rick. Was this to some degree predictable, given the troubled history that Broward County especially has, but also Palm Beach County has a history in stretching out some elections, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it sounds that it was more predictable in terms of Broward because of the problems they've had more recently. I think in Palm Beach County's case, it was just it ended up being a decision made by the supervisor of elections to try to save money and according to her, try to make sure that she didn't come in violation of an upcoming federal law, and it came back to bite her. Mm-hmm. Because we just did not have the tabulating machines to do the recount properly and in time. The other problem, I think, though, on a broader scale, is the fact that the election law, I think, is kind of ridiculous to have a county the size of Broward, which is counting some 600,000 votes, be on the same deadline as a county like the size of Bay, which is counting maybe 16,000 or 20 and 30,000, and tell them, okay, you both have the same time to meet this very fast deadline. That just makes no sense whatsoever. That's not making any excuse, obviously, for the incompetence that we saw, particularly in Broward, and even the bad decision on the part of Palm Beach County. But I think that's a broader thing that needs to be dealt with in terms of the legislature.
Nancy Ankrum, it is another stain on Florida's election history here, certainly. We're talking about even ballot design and undervoting and overvoting. And did people see the ballot question for the U.S. senator buried at the bottom left-hand corner, or did they see it somewhere else? But all of this belies the fact that these are incredibly tight election results. The race for governor in 2010 and 2014, when Governor Scott won, it was a margin of about 60, 65,000 votes. We knew these races are going to be tight, and they fulfilled that expectation in incredibly tight statewide races.
Right, exactly. What we are seeing in Florida is the same almost down the middle divisions that we see nationwide. I think it is fascinating that Andrew Gillum is the third Democratic gubernatorial candidate to lose by such a slim, slim margin. And, of course, we have to ask, does the state Democratic Party, is it, to what degree is it really paying attention to this? Mm. To what degree is it able to get enough of its people out?
Well, Rosemary, let's rewind a little bit and remember the primary here that led to Mayor Gillum's nomination. I think it caught a lot of people off guard that watch politics, that Gwen Graham wasn't the Democratic nominee, that Phil Levine, the former mayor of Miami Beach, wasn't the Democratic nominee, both of them having some name recognition in different places, but spending a lot of money, and were seen as kind of the standard bearers to some degree. One being a very familiar name in Democratic politics, that being former Representative Graham, the other being more a bit more progressive and with a very deep-pocketed, self-funded campaign, that being former Mayor Levine. But here comes Mayor Gillum.
Right. About 15 years ago, Florida changed its primary law, not in a way that would let the 30% of voters who are independents actually get to vote, which is the way they should change the law. The way they changed it is that in a party's primary, there's no more runoff, because runoffs would, you know, were the Maytag repairmen. Nobody would show up for that. So this was the first time we saw, you know, the Republican Party has great party discipline, in part because they've been in office and control the agenda and the bully pulpit. So they had two candidates. Their preferred candidate won. In the Democratic Party, there were five. And really, you know, whoever won there was going to be no runoff. And so with 34% of the vote, Andrew Gillum became the nominee. And I guess the other point I would make is just the money in politics. Let us not forget that in a race that is decided by 30,000 votes, you know, way less than a rounding margin. Governor Scott in the Senate race spent $64.5 million of his own money, almost $65 million of his own money. One of the most five highest races ever. And, you know, why? It's just the money in politics. It changes the narrative. It floods the airwaves. It influences the message. And the Republicans outraise the Democrats.
Another influence in this race that changes the narrative and influenced the politics, of course, was the guy in the White House, President Trump, not on the ballot, Rick Christie. But in terms of the Republican gubernatorial race, changed the tone of that race considerable in the spring and summertime. Adam Putnam, the former Commissioner of Agriculture, remember, was the standard bearer, the guy who had been running for governor of Florida for many, many years in terms of what his career trajectory looked like. And then here come a relatively junior congressman from the Jacksonville area, Ron DeSantis, with the president's Fox News Channel kind of endorsement, and sure enough, runs away with the Republican primary.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, to be honest with you. It seemed to everyone that this governorship was Adam Putnam's from the beginning. As soon as he announced, and he announced some time ago, I think it was pretty much everybody thought that he was going to win it. And again, as you said, here comes President Trump riding a wave of popularity in Florida from his victory. And getting behind Ron DeSantis, who just parroted the president and was able to not only win the Republican nomination, but win it handily, which was really the more of the surprise for me. I thought it would have been much closer than it was, because, again, Adam Putnam is about as good old boy Florida as you would get. And everything, but again, I believe the cult of personality just overtook him in this particular case.
Nancy?
Right. I think there were at least two things at play here. We editorialized after the general elections that Florida needs open primaries, not closed primaries.
And that's what Rosemary was referring
to. Yeah, exactly. Just to piggyback on that. And that, you know, I think that really did in both the Putnam and Graham. Because they do represent the middle. They really represent the middle, which we have gotten kind of used to. They have institutional experience and memory. And party aside, that is what you want. I also think that this is a year in which across the country we saw familiar names and people with that experience that maybe people of a certain age value just fall by the wayside.
Yeah, and the primary example is Bill Nelson, a two-term senator, longtime public servant, elected official, began back in the 70s in the Florida House of Representatives, losing his third-term reelection bid to, you mentioned, a $64.5 million campaign with Governor Scott.
You know, the this election, though, was not about people in the middle. In the governor's race, they were as far to the right and as far to the left as they could be. And I think, even think Adam Putnam, who I used to consider, you know, center right, he had to run far to the right in order to try to win that primary. I would just say that the big surprise for me in the election was that almost every constitutional amendment passed, except the constitutional amendment that would have given homeowners a tax break. I don't know. And one of those that passed requires that supervisors of election be elected, not appointed.
And sheriffs now,
and
too.
And sheriffs, too. And at the local level, taxes passed all over the state.
Higher tax
increases for schools, for transportation, for local bond referendums. And so it just seemed to me this year that, you know, that whole pledge of no new taxes, read my lips. This year, those, you know, the tax increases were something that voters went for.
But you know what? Voters went for them, not the elected officials who are really too afraid to enact these things themselves. It's not bad that it goes to the voters, but you know, I think we need elected officials who can make the hard choices and can explain them and make the case. And that's not what we're seeing.
We saw, again, amendments voted on by supporters put on the ballot with the inaction of the legislature. Specifically, Rick, I'm thinking about Amendment 4, which is the restoration of felon voting rights. Which was a clear response to Governor Scott and his operations and how he has dealt with clemency in the state of Florida, reduced incredibly the number of felons who get their voting rights back compared to previous governors, including Charlie Crist and Jeb Bush, as your paper detailed in the Palm Beach Post. But here, as we're ending the year, we're seeing slow walking by the DeSantis administration about the implementation of Amendment 4 and the possible re-enfranchisement of, what, a million or a million and a half potential Florida voters now who are felons.
Right. And I think the DeSantis, Governor DeSantis seems to be taking his cues from the Scott administration on this. I think that already Secretary of State Ken Detzner had already indicated to election supervisors that maybe the legislature needs to take a look at this first and give us implementation or some marching orders on this thing. And I think Governor DeSantis seemed to just be parroting that now. And it's really frustrating given the fact that when you read this amendment, it's probably one of the clearest amendments, constitutional amendments we've seen in quite a while. It just basically says, as of January 8th, anyone who has done their time and everything can go in and apply to for their right to vote.
Right.
And as I said before on this particular one, it's just going to take somebody going into an election supervisor's office and registering to vote. Someone who's been frustrated by this process going in and doing it, and the courts are just going to have to step in. I think that's what the next thing is going to happen with it.
We also saw the environment play a significant role, arguably, in this election in ways that we hadn't seen it prior. Some of this driven by blue-green algae again this summer that a number of our communities in and around Lake Okeechobee experience, but also Red Tide in the Gulf Coast beginning to make its way around in the fall here into South Florida. I know Palm Beach County and Broward County had some instances in Red Tide on the Atlantic coast. We saw voters approve of a constitutional amendment banning offshore drilling in state waters in Florida. Rosemary, you mentioned several bond amendments that were approved. Some of those include money for resiliency and response to flooding and dry day flooding. And we saw the eventual governor-elect here swear off sugar money for a Republican and talk about his environmental hopes and dreams for the Everglades and elsewhere. So talk to us a little bit about the role the environment played in this election cycle, in your estimation.
You know, I think our attention span is just so short that it's sort of defined by the tweet of the day. And so in the spring, we thought the election would be affected by the Stoneman Douglas shooting. In the summer, we thought it would be about the environment. Mm-hmm. But in the end, when you look at those counties that were most affected by the blue-green algae and the red tide, they voted for people who have not got a strong record of standing up for the environment, but rather for watering down the Clean Water Act, for letting Florida set the standards. So it's like people just reflexively went to their safe corners where they think they know what their party stands for. Mm. And so I don't think the environment in the end, after
play
all
role.
Of the images or sea level rise, the things we've been talking about all year, no, I don't think in the end that those were defining factors. It was a question of trust and who do I align with, generally speaking.
Let me ask about the congressional delegation, because we are seeing some changes there. Two Republicans from South Florida in the delegation that we send to Congress leaving, replaced by two Democrats, one Republican retiring, Aliana Ross Layton retiring after 29 years in Congress, being replaced by Donna Shalala, Democrat, and then Carlos Curbelo losing his third term reelection effort to Debbie Mercosol Powell in the 26th congressional district, which includes South Dade into the Keys. Notable change as the Democrats take control of Capitol Hill, Nancy Ankrum?
It is notable change because, again, as I said earlier, people went for the unfamiliar suspects, the unusual suspects, even though Shalala is a name we all know. But in the race for to replace Carlos Curbelo, I think that that district now does lean Democratic.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Curbelo, unfortunately, was probably a victim of some of his moderation. But he was not moderate enough where it counts. And he would vote with this president in terms of health care and tax cuts. Even though at the same time, he was more than willing to, in a bipartisan manner, deal with climate change. Mm-hmm. And I think voters in that district said, well, heck, let's just get a real Democrat in there. And Debbie Mercosol Powell was a credible candidate. She knew the issues. She was engaged. It was her second run for office.
That's right.
And they put her in there. Shalala was an unusual suspect in that.
A very crowded field in there.
It was a crowded field. She did become the 800-pound gorilla, but it wasn't. It was not a lock for her. She was running against Maria Elvira Salazar, mm-hmm. you know, out of left field, a Spanish-language TV journalist, who also presented very credibly, very, I want to say knowledgeably, but maybe not as knowledgeable. She had a steeper learning curve, mm-hmm. you know, come to find out. And I think voters really weren't sure how closely aligned she was with Trump or not.
Well, all that changes, of course, in January with the Democrats taking control of Capitol Hill, at least in terms of the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. And we will see how that Florida delegation and the makeup of that Florida delegation impacts certainly how policies are debated and portrayed for the South Floridians here. In our state. So we got a lot more to come here. 2018, long year, lots of news, immigration, transportation, more on the environment. What big news affected you in the past year? Share it with us, won't you, on Twitter, at WLRN. The South Florida Roundup will continue after this. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening this week. Thanks for listening this year, 2018. Going by us here as we spend an hour reviewing some of those big news items in the past year with the editorial page editors, with the Miami Herald, Nancy Ankrum, with the South Florida Sun Sentinel, Rosemary O'Hara, and with the Palm Beach Post, Rick Christie. Big news for you. Share it with us on social media at WLRN. Maybe it was the birth of your first grandchild. Maybe you got a new car. Maybe you graduated high school or had one of your kids graduate high school, or you did graduate college. Whatever that big news was for you, share it with us on social media at WLRN. So still lots to talk about here. We could talk about immigration. We could talk about the economy. We could talk about transportation. So much still left to talk about. But let's talk quickly here, Rick and Rosemary and Nancy, about immigration here, because this is dominating the national debate here, even at the end of the year, the debate over government shutdown and building a wall or whatnot. Well, temporary protection status, we know in the past year, the clock is ticking for a number of groups that have had TPS here in South Florida, from El Salvador, from Nicaragua, from Haiti. Meantime, a Homestead Detention Center had protesters rallying this summer against the Trump administration's family separation policies. The deferred action against childhood arrivals is still being hotly debated. Nancy, how about the year that was for immigration in South Florida?
Yeah, it was a rocky year for immigration advocates. And of course, so much of this is because Congress has just punted year after year after year, failing to tackle any kind of comprehensive immigration reform. So people are on rocky ground. A lot of people are on rocky ground, including Haitians and Nicaraguans and El Salvadorans who have been given the heave-ho. Their advocates are working hard to save them. We don't know what we can expect from a new Democratic U.S. Mm-hmm. House. And, of course, DACA is still top of mind for so many people.
Yeah.
And they, too, are at risk. They
Let me ask about some foreign relations that affect daily life here in South Florida. A new Cuban leader taking over from Raul Castro this year. Has that changed the dynamic in the relationship between South Florida and the island?
You know, I think it's just a younger version of same old in Cuba. And we do have the sonic attacks that are now, you know, people are pointing at Russia and at Putin, you know, our favorite villain, mm-hmm. but also because he often is.
Yeah. And across the sea is Venezuela. That economic tragedy continues to just worsen almost hourly.
Colombia is just staggering under the hundreds of thousands of refugees who are crossing that bridge.
Oh, wow. It is horrific what's happening in Venezuela. I mean, there's no drugs in the hospitals. There's no food on the shelf. The economy is inflation is at 1,000,000%. And as we watch what a country that has enormous natural resources but is led by a corrupt dictator fall, it's like, what do we do? And what we've done is impose these sanctions, which is really better than military invasion, but yet the sanctions are really hurting the people there. Venezuela is the worst country right now in the Western Hemisphere, and all we can do is watch this misery unfold.
And that's balanced against domestically a pretty strong economy here in South Florida. Record low unemployment rate in our mm-hmm. counties, Rick Christie. Home prices at the high end have wavered in the past year, but in the middle, still affordability challenges, mm-hmm. Showing strong demand for that middle of the market home.
Yeah, I think the economy is an interesting question right now, because while most people don't realize, we've been in an economic boom situation for a number of years now, which started under the Obama administration. Now we're riding the sugar high from the Trump administration that's really kind of starting to wear off. The tax bill that was passed largely by, well, all by the Republican Congress. Now you're seeing that it really didn't have the effect that everybody thought it was going to have. Most of the money that corporations got, they used for stock buybacks rather than paying people more mm-hmm. money. The stock market is starting to react now because, again, coming off of this sugar high, they're like, okay, where are things going from here? And so you'll see this, the markets gyrating, the Dow gyrating 500 points yeah. from day to day, which is not very good for people's pensions and 401ks. And another crack that's starting to show up that people are starting to talk about also is debt. Of course, the Republican Party, which has always been the party of fiscal responsibility, now is riding this $21 trillion deficit and not even talking about it. So I think that that right now, although we are, again, seeing record low unemployment, and thank goodness housing prices are high, the other side of that is housing affordability in Florida is really becoming a bad, bad issue.
Nancy?
Right, and the other side of that is that, yes, there's low unemployment, but are these jobs paying a living wage?
Yeah, yeah. The quality of the jobs.
The quality
themselves.
Of the yep. job. Yeah. And this and is an outset, just an outcome of, this is a very low-wage community.
Mm-hmm.
Income inequality is, I think we have maybe the
among the highest,
gap,
if not
the highest
yeah.
in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And so that needs to be addressed yeah. among all of the cheering about low unemployment.
And just looking ahead, you know, we end the year with the stock market falling in a big way, with talk of interest rates on their way up.
Yeah.
And it's just a question of when are we going to see this course correction? Mm. Is it going to be in 2019, you know, and what do we do?
Let's talk a little bit about the Invading Sea, a project that we've collaborated on all year long to raise awareness around climate change and specifically around a higher sea level. We mentioned earlier about how the environment may or may not have played a role in the election here in 2018. Rick, are you what kind of confidence do you have that the community conversation around climate change, generally and specifically sea level rise, has gotten the attention that frankly this deserves?
What? As much as it deserves. Well, I don't know if I'll say that, but I will say that I believe that the awareness around the issue has been raised a lot. I thought we did all the work that we put into this, that the conversation itself has broadened. Very encouraged by that. I think with the Democrats taking over the U.S. Congress, that There is room for optimism that there will be some forward movement on this. Ted Deutsch, U.S. Representative mm-hmm. Ted Deutsch, I believe, in Northern Broward and Southern Palm Beach County, is leading a coalition of congressmen to talk about this and move us forward in terms of talking about carbon taxes
yep.
or carbon fees, I guess.
Yeah.
And this whole issue. And given the fact that the Democrats will now have control of the House, there's room for optimism that there will be more discussion on this.
And we've seen in the past just few months here, as we close out 2018, the city of Miami, Nancy Ankrum, begin to put into place borrowing that voters approved in 2017 to address dry day flooding, higher seas, to raise roads and put storm pumps in.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, we talked earlier about people voting for candidates, Republican candidates, who can really be blamed for red tide, their policies, red tide, blue-green algae.
Well, red tide is natural, but blue-green algae
right.
is not.
It's natural, but the intensity mm-hmm. this year
no
was
doubt.
What really
yeah.
was not.
Off
and
the charts,
there were
yeah.
policies in terms of monitoring this that could have flagged this much earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, as in so many instances, the locals get it, when perhaps people operating at the state level do not. Also on Miami Beach, voters approved a referendum that will fund mm-hmm. a number of resiliency initiatives.
And in Hollywood, some of the bond referendum money voters okayed is going to go for seawalls. Some
yeah,
of it's going to go for
a
police
pittance,
station.
A pittance
but some
is
of it will
gonna
be going
go
to
go for seawalls. You know, it's like people think that the fact that the water's going to rise 2 feet in 40 years, 2 feet in 40 years is a long time away. And so let's build a police station and fix up golf courses instead.
Mm.
You know, it's we need to be acting now. And it's the reason the Miami Herald, Palm Beach Post and Sun Sentinel editorial pages with WLRN that we all came together this year to try to raise awareness. And so I would just encourage your listeners to let your lawmakers know We want something done. We need something done about sea level rise to prepare.
We talk about it a lot here on the South Florida Roundup. And a happy new year to everybody. Rosemary, great to have you. Happy
you,
new year to you and yours. Nancy, thank you for everything you've done for
thank
us throughout
you.
The year. And Rick, always great to have you. Happy new year to you
happy
and your
year to
growing
you.
Family as well. All the best in the brand new year. Our program is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontato is our digital director. Our news director is Taryn Shepherd, Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director, the director of radio programming, and our technical supervisor is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening, thanks for supporting, and have a wonderful new year.